Welcome to CFO Talk. I'm Steve Rosevall, Chief Learning Officer at CFO.University. Today, joining us from the city of Trawlings and the Golden Gate Bridge is Mark Kofkin. Mark's career has been spent in the hedge fund and private equity space as an analyst, then as an investor, and more recently as the CFO of a fast-growing SaaS company. Mark performed his undergraduate work in finance at the University of California in Berkeley and earned his MBA from Harvard University. Welcome, Mark. It is a pleasure to have you on CFO Talk.
Great to be here. Very excited, Steve. Thank you.
We've got a great topic to talk about. I know that you've written a lot, or you've written a great article that had to do with annual recurring revenue based on your growth plans at a SaaS company you worked at, where you grew 10 times over 5 or 6 years. So I really want to hone into that and grab kind of some of your learnings so we can share those with our CFO audience. And one of your learnings that you talk about is to scale, you have to do customer segmentation. And so I want to dig into that and have you dig into that a little deeper on what that means and how you were involved in that whole process.
Last company I was at the CFO that Steve mentioned was a B2B subscription as a service company called Pantheon, a leader in web apps category. I joined the company in 2017, definitely post product market fit. Was a very typical Silicon Valley venture-backed startup, and I joined post product market fit. And what happens as the company initially develops the thesis for the product, identifies the problem, then builds the product to solve the problem, the founders and maybe community around them and maybe early adopters in the space find your solution on their own. And so there's a lot of inbound, a lot of community outreach and word of mouth awareness, mostly with early adopters. Those are the people who always want to improve the way they operate and always look at every possible new technology to help them operate their businesses better. And again, I'm talking about B2B software. And so this early phase into product market fit is somewhat easier to get clients because it's most of it is inbound. And towards the end of this product market fit proof points, you start doing a little bit of outbound, but you're still in the easier stage. Still a lot of word of mouth, a lot of referrals, and your team is still smaller and your funds are still don't allow you to start reaching out at scale. Now, at some point, post-product market fit, you raise the next round of funding and your investors now having confirmed that you've built a real solution to a real problem, that you have paying customers, that your paying customers come back and renew in terms of in the subscription world. Now, all of a sudden, you have money and your task is to go out to the outside world and start some sort of outbound motion. And now you need to attract potential prospects, build awareness, and take them through this initial funnel into conversion and sale. But the world is huge, and you may have multiple messages that you want to convey to the world, and you may have multiple product packages that you want to offer to the world. Now, the world is not homogeneous, and you need to realize that in any different product for every different company, your customers can always be segmented into buckets where a given message and a given packaging will resonate better. Further, some of those segments may have different willingness to pay based on multiple factors, how much value they get out of the product, based on their own profitability, based on profitability of their end clients. And so your job as the CFO and somebody who is impartial, someone who has skills of looking outside in and understanding the competitive environment, understanding the economics of your buyers, you have the skill to figure out how best to segment your universe of potential customers. Your segment is based on identifiable metrics, attributes in the wild. You segment your customer base based on what problems they're trying to solve. And therefore, you adapt your packaging and messaging and pricing to each segment. And then as a CFO, your job is to figure out the unit economics of each of those buckets based on what you're intending to provide.
I think that kind of leads us right into the next question, which has to do with data. And you talk about having a data culture is one of the most important things, because all those things you're talking about, those attributes, take data, I assume. So help us get down that. How do you create a data culture that can lead to getting information on all those attributes and be able to help the business that way?
Every decision that will lead you down the path of segmentation and tailoring the offering to proper segments will have to be data informed, not necessarily data driven, and we can talk about defined a difference, but at a high level, every decision has a part is part science and part art. And the part science is what I call data informed. In subscription companies, I imagine the role of data is higher because the whole point of having a subscription, at least for software, is that at any given point in time, as the company, you know exactly how the product is being used and by whom within the organization. Now, to your point about setting up data culture, I'd say it takes two or three main components. At a high level, one, you need to instrument the data so that the users and the decision makers within the company have timely, reliable data from the systems that actually capture the data. And they have it at their fingertips, and they're able to manipulate it in a way that answers their decision. That answers their question and they use it to make a decision. Second pillar is having the necessary culture where people talk about decisions they made in terms of the data that led them to make that decision. The disagreements within the leadership team, and the leadership team could be at the executive level, or the leadership team could be at a level of a function or at the level of a director with their direct reports. The disagreements are about the logic of how they get to an endpoint from the starting point, as opposed to their philosophy on life or prior experience or what they think the customer needs and wants and things like that. So it's how the actual conversations are had and what part of the conversation is about data that they're able to gather. And then we get to the third pillar, which is how acceptable it is within the company to run experiments. And experiments is purely a cultural thing. Kind of as I've gone through the three pillars, data instrumentation, decision making, and experiments, I'm going from most science to most cultural phenomenon. And experimentation is purely culture, because if you do experiments, some of them will fail. Some of your hypothesis will be incorrect. Some of the pace of decision-making, the pace of the experimentation, the pace of delivery of new product features, of decisions that you need to make going forward, all of this is cultural. Getting approval to run experiments where you know some customers may be unhappy because you will be offering them something they don't need, frankly. So it's all about having the mindset within the company where an experimental failure is your learning that something does not work and that has value. So that's how I would think about data culture.
You talked about being data informed and being agile, really. You're saying making quick understanding quickly the result of an experiment is pretty important in growing your revenue 10 times over 5 years like you did. You have to make a lot of mistakes. And you have to fix them.
Yes.
Good. We talk about data being critical in evaluating the customer lifecycle. So let's go into that a little deeper and help us understand, is that just a pipeline or what kind of data points are you looking at to develop that customer lifecycle and be able to get and make informed decisions out of it?
Yeah, that's actually, I'd say, way more than pipeline. Pipeline is one starting point, and that assumes a very sales-driven approach. The other approach is what industry now calls, at least for software, product-led growth, where the end users of the product actually self-discover your product, self-educate themselves, mostly by trial and error. So they set up an account and they start using the product. It's hard to call it a pipeline, although one may, but the learning there is, what is it that they do? When do they get to the aha moment? And every software company must have an aha moment as part of their vocabulary, as part of their arsenal. And that is the point in the usage journey where the end user all of a sudden realizes, ah, that is why I'm here. Aha, that is what will change my day to day. And that is what will enable me to do my job better, faster, and with fewer resources, or one of those. On the one hand, it's the pipeline. On the other hand, it's the experimentation journey by the end user. So then let's assume the customer converts to being, the prospect converts to being a paying customer. And now the usage journey starts. And ideally, it goes from a little bit to more. In some products, they especially have virality, super highly valued by investors. Are people bringing other team members to use the product? Is there corporate expansion? Is one department referring and educating potentially other departments, bringing the other departments into the fold of your product? What is that expansion journey? And then you have happy paths and you have failure modes. Tracking that and understanding what is it causes different customers or groups of users to go to the happy path or not. And finally, you have ultimately churn. We all hope that all of our customers stay with the product forever and ever, but the reality is some will stay for 24 months, some will stay for a year and will not renew the license or will not buy an upgrade, but some will stay for a few years and a few will stay for 5+. Because the reality is that different management comes, corporate objectives change, companies get acquired, companies go bankrupt, and things, life happens. And so very important to understand what is it within your product you could adapt or change to minimize that risk.
So there's a component. The data component tells you how many users are on the site. Are they inviting their friends? Are they using it once a day, once a week, once a month? Are they on it for 15 minutes or 3 seconds? All that kind of thing. That data you get because they're on your site. How do you, the human component that says, why did they change their behavior? Why did they move? How do you get that information?
This is very much related to the notion I introduced of data-informed versus data-driven. The data-driven is what you discussed, all the data you get from your product. Data-informed is actual human-to-human interviews, working with your account management team or customer success team, figuring out what is it that the values that your end customer delivered to their end customer. How did your end customer realize the initial thesis for buying the software to begin with. And that comes from, there's no other way to do it other than having interviews, and you could interview different people within the organization. For some of those products, users and economic beneficiaries are vastly different people. And so you need to do a good job with staying in touch, especially around inflection points within the journey, or if you see something maybe a risk factor to potential churn. Now with all the proliferation of AI tools that can summarize your call recordings, it became a little bit easier. But again, the culture is that you can't just rely on a multiple choice survey that you send out or the product data. You need that human interaction and understanding of the what is it that the humans within the firms think? And I think that's where AI will help us and actually create more jobs to interview your customers and develop that human connection.
The human component just gets deeper and deeper. So the data that you get gets richer and richer so that humans can ask better and better questions.
The data rarely tells you why. You need to overlay that on your understanding of the industry and common knowledge, common sense, frankly. Data will tell you that brownies and sales of ice cream correlate. But then you need to interview people, hopefully not the ground, but you need the sellers of ice cream to and apply your knowledge of the industry, knowledge of the problem, and knowledge of the product to then realize the actual cause and effect relationship. That's very much human judgment.
I know that you feel the annual recurring revenue is a really important metric, SaaS metric, but I want to get, what are the other SaaS metrics that you found very valuable in your journey? Can you name a few of them and explain how you use them effectively?
The other set of metrics deal with customer expansion. And that is basically a measure of how much more your customers value your solution year after year. How can you upsell additional products into the same customer? How can you expand the usage within the same customer by geo or by department? How many logos you keep versus your churn? Or if you're doing, for example, usage-based in terms of seats, are you attracting more users? If you're doing usage-based in terms of some megabytes or some compute usage, is that expanding? And so on. Now, there are a couple of metrics there. One of the most often used ones is called net dollar retention. And a lot of public SaaS companies report a version of this. None of this is GAAP. People define it in the way that allows them to put themselves in the best possible way. But basically, that comes down to taking a cohort of customers and looking at their revenue year one, and then taking exact same cohort of customers and looking at their revenue in year two. And doing the ratio. So that's one. The other one is logo retention. So the same thing just with logos. Of 100 logos you had in year one, how many are still active customers 12 months later? And there are two different things. They can, from time to time, they may move in concert, but they may not. So you may have, of 100 customers, you may have 99 for churn, but one that 200x they're spending. And that could be part of the business model, or that could be a huge problem. And so every customer, every company needs to decide for themselves which business model they pursue and structure their teams accordingly based on what is the retention and how is this retention spread out within the cohort. That drives a lot of those decisions about organization design.
Retention and churn are two sides of the same coin.
Two sides of the same coin. The difference I was alluding to is dollar-based versus logo-based.
Right. Great. You brought up something, so I'm going to take a little segue here for a minute because it brought up an interesting point in my head anyway. You talked about some of the metrics and they're not being GAAP. As the CFO, did you find conflicts when you're talking to the auditors, having a report out, and your marketing people are doing something different? Was there conflicts there, or was it something that was relatively easy to manage?
It was fairly easy to manage. One is purely for managerial decision-making. The other one is purely for outside in performance. I'd imagine that issue gets a little trickier when public companies start disclosing non-GAAP metrics, but it's a well-known path. Auditors, I had multiple conversations as I started on the journey, and auditors know and realize what is happening. The key is consistency. What you don't want to do is change how you measure things equally. But as long as you're consistent quarter to quarter, the definitions, if they're well explained, there shouldn't be a lot of conflict there.
One of your key lessons was to align the organizational design with the customer journey. And to quote you, you summarize this as aligning customer workflows with their buying preferences and your unit economics. It's interesting. Can you dive into that a little deeper for me? And I found that really compelling.
Yeah, at the highest level, what you want to avoid is throwing a team of junior salespeople making phone calls all day long. And then when they get a meeting scheduled or they convince the prospect to have a demo, they pass it on to the account executive. The account executive spends a whole bunch of time. If there is a more complicated demo or some technical question that needs to be resolved, it gets thrown over the wall to a sales engineering team and possibly partner team and all of that. And all those people are highly paid. They're in the Bay Area. And all you get when you come out of this process is a $15,000 ARR contract. And that's a great example of what would happen if your segmentation is wrong. What in that example, what happened is a customer came in, but something went wrong in your logic of workflow channeling and how you send each that particular prospect into your wheel, if you will, into the maze of your workflows. What should have happened is if a prospect comes in and your systems identify that prospect as part of the segment that will likely sign up for $10,000 to $20,000 contract, that should ideally just be sent to self-fulfillment or product-led growth, or perhaps you have a very junior sales employee, few years out of college, ideally not in San Francisco, having a quick call, educating, answering a few questions, and sending again the customer back on the sales purchasing journey, and then your unit economics work. Now, on the other hand, if this is a prospect comes in and you're identified as a potential enterprise buyer with $100,000 to $150,000 potential, then you send this particular customer into a very different path, where there's an account executive and a sales engineer and maybe even field sales, and some bunch of people get invited to a conference. Like, very different. And so as a CFO, you need to figure out unit economics for each of those segments. And if something gets thrown off, that's a red flag that you are either your segmentation is wrong or your workflow is wrong. And what I mean by workflow is wrong, it means wrong people are thrown at wrong customers. And it could go either way. Either very expensive people thrown at customers with low potential, but the reverse is also true. You could be throwing people earlier in their careers at customers that need actual sophisticated sellers to guide them through the journey.
From a costing standpoint, to understand that, you have to understand, you know, the salaries and the talents that are being thrown at things. So that's part of this whole equation on the customer segmentation. You're able to have transparency into that?
You need to have transparency into that. And there's obviously a second component, which is how much time these people spend on an average customer within a cohort. In a company with well implemented data culture, to my earlier point, a lot of those things will be captured in the system of record, whether it's Salesforce or HubSpot. And your analysts, either on the revenue operations side or on the FP&A side, or perhaps both, could make fairly safe assumptions or use real data, but most times one will have to be complemented by the other, where it should be possible to understand for an average customer within a given cohort who on average spends how much time on this prospect and what percentage of those prospects become customers.
To go deeper and further into this customer segmentation, you talked about pricing and packaging as being value-creating areas. And maybe you've covered a little of that, but can you go into that a little bit deeper and maybe share an example of how pricing and packaging, your role in helping identify how to improve pricing or improve the segmentation?
Goes back to segmentation. Different customer segments have different needs, and different needs create or solve different problems, therefore creating different levels of value for them. And the key role of the executive team, but as a CFO being unbiased and most data-driven, you have the ability to lead that discussion and those projects to figure out for each bucket what is the right packaging, what are the right feature set that they would require and why, and therefore how much value your product with that most required feature set would generate.
When you say packaging, again, I come from a consumer products company, so I think of packaging as a box with, and I think you're using it in a different way.
Software feature sets. For example, the simplest, let's take a bookkeeping software. The simplest one would be, okay, only one user, and you can only generate an income statement. And then the better package would be you can have up to 3 users and you can generate 3 statements and link them together. And your best package would have forecasting capability, data would be secure, and you would have user controls, and you would have audit trails, right? And obviously the last one would be the most expensive one, because that would presumably generate a ton of value for real enterprise clients that are sophisticated enough to have all those needs and probably be audited. Whereas the first two would be targeted at smaller companies that don't have these needs, are not sophisticated, probably don't make a whole bunch of money, and are not that profitable. So that's what I mean, and sorry to just clarify, by packaging. And so once you have your segments, and then your hypothesis, this is the most artful part. It's like, why do they need your product and what value they'll get out of it? And then you get to setting the price levels, which could be more of back to science. And there are multiple tools out in the wild that help companies determine pricing levels. I use something called price sensitivity meter in my experience, also known as von Westendorp method, I think. But basically, it's your surveying your customers about what they would think would be a price that's too cheap, or what would be the price that's too expensive, and then you get some sort of a range. There are multiple other questions that you could ask. Now, all of this only works if you have meaningful N, so you have statistically significant data set. And remember, not everybody will reply to your survey, and people will figure out that you're asking this not because you want to lower the price. So you got to be careful, but this is a little bit more scientific, especially for companies that have many users and a lot of data points. But the first two is where your vision for the product and where you work with your product team and the CEO and your marketer and you and sales, and if there is a product-led growth component with your data team to kind of figure out who needs what and why.
Is it ever as simple as saying, hey, if we expect them to make $10 off this product, we want 25% of that? Is it ever that simple, or it's much more complicated than that?
In the early days, it could be that simple. If that's all you have to, it's a legitimate data point. It's a data point. Now, in some cases, it's the only data point, and that is that simple. And other cases, it's not. But especially in the early days, a lot of it is about experimentation. And going back to data culture, how willing are you and how capable are you? How much thought did you give in the early architecture of the product about future need for experimentation? That's at a cultural level. Because somebody needs to think, needs to have the foresight that we're going to do it, but then we will also have experiments. What would that look like? And you don't know, because somebody else will likely be running the experiment. So that's a cultural, almost at a value level, attribute of any group of people.
One last question, because it was a great point that you made, is developing what you call this chief performance officer as the CFO role. So making a chief performance office out of your team takes great people, takes a budget, takes investment. And that's something some CFOs find hard to do. They're always trying to cut costs and they want to be the leader in that. And I think you're looking at it just the opposite way, saying if you want to build a great team, a chief performance team, how did you go about with your board, with your other executives to get the resources you needed to create a chief performance office?
It's the way you hire for and the way people on your team think about their role in the development of the organization. People on my team, I ask them to really understand the business deeply, even though from the outside, it may seem that they're just there to do BVA analysis to no end. But that's not why my team is here. My team is there to enable my other partners around the executive table to be better at what they do. And you enable them to be better at what they do by doing two things. One is making sure everyone around the table is aligned on how and in what sequence your 2 to 3 year strategy is translated into quarterly goals. So everyone is rowing towards the same target in sequentially the same way. And nobody gets ahead of anybody else, nobody gets left behind, and they support each other. So that's why, that's corporate alignment in that comes out a lot in the planning processes and then quarterly goal setting, whether you use OKRs or something else. The second one goes back to enabling good data culture. The teams need to be able to track their performance, to set goals and to track their performance to those goals. And then the culture comes in, cultural element that's driven by the CEO, where if teams have trust, then they're not afraid to admit that they may have challenges or outline risks and ask for help. And the CFO's role and the role of the chief performance officer, which is where I posit the world is going, is to help everyone do that and to help build the culture where people are not afraid to ask for help and identify issues that they see, but maybe that they see in their departments, but maybe other people don't. And it's not an easy thing to accomplish. People have egos, people have career aspirations, people feel fear for a wrong decision, for exposing a questionable decision that they may have had in the past. But that's the leadership and the cultural component that the CFO needs to carry on their shoulders.
I sure appreciate your time, and you dished out not only that beautiful picture of the Golden Gate Bridge behind you, but also a lot of golden nuggets to CFOs all around the world. So that was really wonderful. What a great trip into the SaaS world, and the CFO as a chief performance officer and all the things you covered. So really appreciate having you on CFO Talk today, Mark.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Good luck.
It was great. Yep. Thank you. CFO.University is a community of CFOs, trusted advisors, and companies committed to the professional development of chief financial officers. Find out more about us at www.cfo.university. Until next time, enjoy, learn, engage.
That wraps up today's CFO Talk.